All right, ever feel like you're drowning in a sea of potential plaintiffs? Like you're looking at a case and it just hits you, wow, this could be
Oh,
huge.
yeah, definitely. Especially when you start getting into mass torts, right? You see these big incidents with potentially thousands affected. Talk about feeling overwhelmed.
Today we're going to dive into one of those cases. Buckle up, because we're going back to 1996.
Back in time.
Back in time to Black v. Roan Poulenc. Toxic chemical fire, tons of people possibly hurt. And the big question, can they all join forces and sue together as a class?
Class Action Central. It's a classic example of how messy things can get, especially with mass torts. We're talking about a fire at a Roan Poulenc plant in West Virginia, February 15th, 1996, the day it all went down. And yeah, some really nasty stuff got released. Toluene, MIC, the whole nine yards.
Not the kind of chemicals you want floating around.
Nope. Emergency response was swift, though. Shelter-in-place order went out, trying to contain the damage. But here's the thing. Just 11 days later, boom, a class action lawsuit is filed.
11 days? That's moving at lightning speed for the legal world.
It is. Shows how high the stakes were.
Yeah.
And the lawsuits, they weren't all cut from the same cloth either. Some folks had physical injuries, but a lot of the claims were about emotional distress, the fear, the disruption of having to hunker down, even property damage got thrown into the mix. So right off the bat, you see this tension between the physical harm and, well, everything else.
And that distinction, as we'll see, becomes really important in how the court tackles the whole class certification question.
Oh, yeah. Now, Roan Poulenc, they weren't exactly thrilled at the idea of a massive class action coming their way. Who would be? Right.
I wouldn't.
So they fought back, challenged the certification on some pretty fundamental grounds. First, they questioned whether the folks named as plaintiffs were they really the right people to represent everyone else? Like, could they actually speak for the whole group? Then they argued that each person's situation was so unique, so different, that trying to lump all the claims together was just going to be a mess, impossible to handle fairly.
So, how did the court sort through all this? I know Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 23, or as the cool kids call it, Rule 23, played a big part. But for our listeners who are maybe just starting their legal journey, can we break down exactly what this rule is all about?
Absolutely. Rule 23, it's basically the rule book for class action lawsuits. It
Yep.
lays out all the must-haves before a case can even be considered as a class action. Think of it like a checklist. And in Black v. Roan Poulenc, the plaintiffs, they had to check off every box of Rule 23A just to get things rolling. And even then, it was just a provisional kind of tentative certification.
Provisional certification, so like a test drive for a class action.
Exactly. The court's dipping its toes in, not fully committing yet. Now, let's break down those boxes in Rule 23A. First up is numerosity. Basically, is this group so big that it'd be crazy to have everyone file their own separate lawsuits?
Makes sense. You wouldn't want the court system to be completely bogged down by individual cases if they all share the same root problem.
Right. And in this case, with potentially thousands impacted by the chemical release, well, the court saw that box is checked pretty quickly.
No surprise there. What about commonality? What were those shared questions that Chief Judge Hayden, the judge in this case, identified that kind of tied everyone together?
Here's where it gets interesting. The common threads weren't about the nitty-gritty of each person's injuries, but more about the bigger picture. Things like, was Roan Poulenc negligent? Did they mess up, act carelessly? What exactly were those chemicals that got out? And was this situation so bad that punitive damages, the extra penalties meant to really punish a company, might be on the table? Or even an injunction, a court order, to prevent them from doing something similar again.
So big picture questions that apply to everyone, regardless of how they were personally affected.
Precisely. Now, let's move to typicality and adequacy. This one gets a bit trickier. Remember, Roan Poulenc was arguing that the named plaintiffs, well, they weren't the best folks to represent the entire class. And the court actually picked up on some potential issues there.
Yeah, I remember reading that some of the plaintiffs didn't seem to fully grasp what the lawsuit was all about.
Exactly. And that's a problem, right? The named plaintiffs, they're like the leaders of the pack. If they don't understand the claims themselves, how can they properly represent everyone else? Could lead to conflicts of interest or just a weak case overall.
So, did that completely derail the class action?
Not quite. The court took kind of a middle-of-the-road approach. They went with conditional certification.
What does that even mean?
It's like saying, okay, we see some red flags here, but let's not shut it down completely just yet. Let's see how things play out as we gather more information through discovery. We could always pull the plug later, decertify the class if it turns out it's just not working.
Makes sense, a cautious approach. giving everyone a chance to prove themselves while still keeping the door open to changing course if needed.
Right. It's about balancing that initial need for efficiency with the need to be fair to everyone. Now, buckle up because we're moving on to Rule 23B3, which adds another layer to this whole thing. This is where the concepts of predominance and superiority come in. And this is where Rome Poulenc really started pushing back, arguing that the individual aspects of each claim would just overshadow everything else.
Right. They were saying every person's experience is different, their damages are different, so how can you possibly treat them all the same?
That was their argument. They were basically saying that trying to manage all these individual differences would turn the whole thing into a circus, a bunch of mini trials, defeating the whole purpose of a class action, which is efficiency.
But the court wasn't entirely convinced, right? How did they respond to Rhone Poulenc's concerns?
They acknowledged, yeah, there will be individual damages to figure out if the plaintiffs win on liability. But they also made a key distinction. They said, look, the core question here is about Rhone Poulenc's actions. Were they negligent or reckless? That question, that's the same for everyone.
Like, was the company at fault, period?
Exactly. If they can prove that, then they've cleared a huge hurdle for everyone in the class. The individual stuff, the court said, well, we can tackle that later, maybe through subgroups or using expert testimony to make things more streamlined. So proving fault was the main event. The individual damages were more like side dishes. Important, but not the showstopper.
So liability takes center stage at this point. But what about superiority? How did the court justify that a class action was a better way to handle all this compared to everyone suing on their own?
They had a few solid reasons. First, efficiency. Pure and simple. Imagine the court's nightmare if thousands of separate lawsuits landed on their desks, all essentially about the same incident. You'd have mountains of paperwork, overlapping arguments, and everything moving at a snail's pace. A class action consolidates everything, streamlines the process, and potentially gets everyone a resolution much faster.
From the court's perspective, that's a major win.
It is. But there's another big factor: access to justice. Think about it. Some folks might have had minor injuries, emotional distress, or just the hassle of staying put during that shelter in place. Now, those individual claims, they might not be worth pursuing on their own. The legal fees, the time, all that could easily outweigh any potential payout. But a class action, it empowers those individuals. It bundles their claims together, gives them a stronger voice.
Oh, even folks with smaller claims can get a seat at the table.
Exactly. But remember, it's still conditional certification. The court said, we're keeping a close eye on this. If things get too complicated or unfair down the road, we can always hit the brakes and decertify. It's a flexible system designed to adapt.
Now, we talked about all these different types of harm, but I know not all the claims made it through this initial stage. What happened with those shelter-in-place inconvenience claims?
Well, that's where West Virginia law comes in. The court actually tossed those claims out through a partial summary judgment. Basically, they said, under West Virginia law, you can't just sue for being annoyed or inconvenienced. You got to show some kind of physical injury, property damage, or serious emotional distress. And since a lot of those inconvenience claims didn't involve any of that, they got dismissed.
State law setting the boundaries, even in a federal court. What about the emotional distress claims that did move forward? What did the plaintiffs have to prove to make those claims stick?
The court said, okay, you can't just say you're worried or scared about potential health problems down the road. You need hard evidence. You got to show that you suffered real emotional distress and that it was directly caused by this chemical release, not just some vague fear of what might happen.
Sounds like a high bar to clear.
It is. The law wants to see concrete evidence, a direct link between the event and the distress. Speculation doesn't cut it.
So we've walked through Rule 23, how it played out in Black v. Rhone Poulenc. Now, for our law student listeners, what are the big takeaways here?
Okay, key lessons. Number one, Rule 23 isn't some rigid set of rules set in stone. Courts have wiggle room. They can adapt, make judgment calls, especially in these complex cases, like with that conditional certification.
So it's not always a clear-cut yes or no right away.
Nope. Second, when we're talking about predominance, that idea of common questions outweighing individual ones, remember, liability is often the star of the show. Can you prove the defendant messed up? that can be enough to justify a class action, even if figuring out damages gets a little messy later on.
Liability is the main course.
Exactly. And the third takeaway, those non-physical harms, like emotional distress, you got to have strong proof. Can't just rely on feelings or what ifs. The legal system wants to see solid evidence.
So beyond the legal rules, what about the strategy? What can plaintiffs and defendants learn from this case?
Well, for plaintiffs, this case shows the power of a class action. It's like a giant spotlight putting pressure on the defendant to settle. Imagine facing thousands of individual lawsuits versus one big unified front. Can be a powerful motivator.
Strength in numbers.
Right. On the other hand, defendants, they learn that fighting certification early is key. They got to challenge the adequacy of the representatives, point out the difficulties of handling all those individual differences, especially when it comes to damages.
So a strategic chess match right from the get-go.
Exactly. And as the judge himself said, that decision on certification, it sends a message. It hints at where the case might go, what's at stake. But remember, the court always has the power to decertify if things go off the rails. So it's this constant back and forth between efficiency and fairness, a balancing act that really defines these massive tort cases.
All right, let's sum up this deep dive into Black v. Rompulent. Toxic fire, potential class action, navigating the ins and outs of Rule 23. We talked numerosity, commonality, typicality, adequacy, predominance, superiority, a whole legal vocabulary lesson.
And we saw how state law, in this case West Virginia, played a role, especially with those non-physical damage claims.
So what's the big picture here?
I think this case gives us a glimpse into the strategic moves on both sides, the flexibility of Rule 23, and the court's role in keeping things manageable and fair.
It really makes you think about this balance, right? Efficiency versus individual justice. How do we handle these large-scale harms in a way that's both effective and just? And what does the future hold for Rule 23 as we grapple with these issues? Food for thought, folks.
A lot to ponder.
Definitely.